Thank you. Okay, I it was clear to me by the time I was halfway finished preparing the shiur tonight that we'll have to do this in two stages because there's just too much material to cover. What's tonight is hopefully is to cover the broad differences in terms of halacha, in terms of learning between what we call Sfarad and what we call Ashkenaz. I'll define the terms in a couple of minutes. And then, shiur, which is going to be, I guess, on the 8th of December, we'll discuss specific personalities, although we may get into that a little bit today also. In other words, the next shiur is when we'll really talk about who was Rashi, who were Tosfos, Ramban, Rajba, and so on. Let me try to give you an idea of the outline in terms of the time frame. When these, I mean, the truth of the matter is that the Rav, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, has a famous speech that he gave at a Sheva Brachas in the early 70s, in which he talked about the fact that Torah is in fact eternal, it's an eternal conversation, that we never say so-and-so said, we always see so-and-so says, Rabbi Akiva says, Rabbi Akiva Eger says, Reb Chaim says, and we're all in this sort of transcendent discussion. And that's really true from a legal point of view, from a religious point of view, from an existential point of view. Nevertheless, these people did live in specific times and did represent certain stages in the development of Torah Shebaal Peh, and I hope you'll excuse my Ashkenaz Sfarad because I'm in learning. After all, I've been in Israel for over 20 years, but still, when I learn in Ashkenaz, but I lecture in Ivrit, so you'll probably just get confused. But you become, as I told Rabbi Ryan, you become illiterate in two languages when you move here. So that's the way it goes. In any event, what I'm going to do is give you sort of like the general framework. We're going to talk today about, after doing that, we will speak about the what is the Gemara? What is this work that we're discussing? How does it become the fountain of all Torah subsequently? Then we're going to go on and talk about commentaries on the Gemara, why they were necessary, how come the first full commentary on the Gemara was not written until the 11th century. So the question is, what happened? How come? So then we'll talk about that, and then we're going to talk about the last point is preparatory to our discussing specific Rishonim is going to be the question of what are the differences between Ashkenazim and Sfardim with regard to the question of truth, and we'll see exactly how that works out. We'll see that in fact the question of truth is a machlokis, but that's pretty that's to be expected. Define our terms. It's always an important thing to do. When we talk about Ashkenaz, okay, Ashkenaz in the Torah is a place called, in Tanakh actually, is a place called, oh no, it's in the Torah, is a place called Scythia. Scythia is a country in Asia Minor, to the east of Turkey. That is what Ovad, the prophet Ovad, is discussing. How that name got attached to Jews who lived in Germany, the Rhineland, France, and later, for a short spell in England, nobody knows. To this day, nobody can figure it out, but that's the name that was used. We really don't know. We don't even know why Tsarfat, which is also a biblical name, is associated with France. No idea. Same thing with Sfarad. Sfarad is a city on the Mediterranean, probably somewhere between Turkey and, Turkey, Syria, Lebanon, northern Israel, somewhere in there. How it got associated with the Iberian Peninsula, again, nobody knows. It just is. However, when we discuss Sfarad, we'll come back to that in 2 minutes, we have to be very careful, but put that aside for a second. The only medieval name for a country that we know, that for which we know the reason why we call the country that name is because the area of what's today the Czech Republic, Slovakia. When I was a kid, there was a country called Czechoslovakia, which doesn't exist anymore. In medieval times, it was called Bohemia and Moravia. In Hebrew, it is called Canaan. Why is it called Canaan? Because it's the area, those areas are called Slavic countries, including Poland for that matter. Why are they called Slavic countries? Well, one of the etymologies is, at least the one that the Jews understood, was that was where Christian slavers used to kidnap blonde men and women to become slaves and ship them off to Muslim countries because the Arabs liked blondes. It's actually true still, but anyways. Okay? So therefore, the area is called Canaan. That's not a racist comment. It just is. Okay? And that's where it's called Canaan because Arur Canaan Eved Avadim Yehiyeh Le'echav. It's the only one that we know. In any event, when we speak, so Ashkenaz really is France and Germany, and then as history goes on, Eastern Europe after the Jews moved there. Sfarad, we have to be careful. Okay? There are two types of Sfardim, and you have to be precise in the way you use the word. Sfarad properly used means just the people who lived in the Iberian Peninsula. People from Portugal, Spain, or in medieval terms, Castile, Aragon, Valencia, Granada, Navarre, Catalonia, that's Sfarad proper. That is not the same as Edot HaMizrach. Edot HaMizrach, which what we call Sfardim, takes in a swath of Jewry which starts at Spain and goes all the way to Afghanistan and northwestern India. North Africa, Syria, you name it. Okay, people who never set foot in Iberia. Why do we homogenize them to that way? For a very simple reason. It's not just Ashkenazi racism, although there have been those who accuse us of that too. The real reason is because from a Jewish point of view, from a cultural point of view, there is tremendous unity and homogeneity among that entire Jewry from Spain to Afghanistan. The reason is because all of those communities lived under whom? Under Islam in their formative eras. So that they all derive their halacha and their liturgy and many of their minhagim and so on. And as we'll see in a second, their theory of halacha and their theory and their approach to learning from the Gaonim of Bavel, who were the de facto rulers, together with the Rosh Gola, of those all of those communities up until at least the 10th, early 11th century. Okay? You know, 11th century means the thousands, right? That's, I don't have to explain that. Okay. All right. Hey, listen, not everybody knows. Depends. Listen, if I were giving this in Italian, I would have to, when it's the 1400s, we say the 15th century. But in Italian, you'd say the 400, the 400s, and you'd drop off the one. So it, you know, it's not so off the wall. I'm practicing because tomorrow I'm supposed to meet with the rectors of five Italian universities in Tel Aviv to convince them to do stuff with Bar Ilan, and I have to practice my Italian. Anyway, it happens. In any case, okay. So when we talk of Sfardin in this context, we will not necessarily just be speaking about the Jews of Hispania. We're talking about the Jews who lived under Muslim rule and were influenced and impacted by the Gaonim in ways that we'll see are very, very significant. I will already here mention, okay, a point which there is a world war going on among scholars. Scholars fight about these things because so little is dependent upon it. About what sets Ashkenazim apart from Sephardim. One of the theories, a theory to which I subscribe to a certain degree, not totally, to a certain degree, is the fact that ultimately the Jews of Ashkenaz, of France and Germany, came from the land of Israel. Jews moved at the time of the destruction of the temple to Italy, actually before that even as well. Apparently Nero's favorite wife, in fact, was a Giaret Sedek. There seems to be indications. Okay, well, listen, you can't judge who we're going to marry. Read the Pew report. From there they moved into northern Italy, from northern Italy into the Rhineland in the 10th century. And apparently, there's every reason to think that many, many, many things in which Jews of Ashkenaz are different from Sephardim is because of sort of an addition of traditions of Eretz Yisrael, which I can't go into, but that's one part of the mix. Okay, so that's the geography. All right, that's basically the two communities we're talking about. The Yemenites is a whole different culture. It's a very similar to everybody else, but it's different. And I just can't go into it right now, and I really am not enough of an expert to be able to even say what, even though I have the temerity to right now have a doctoral student who's writing a doctorate about the, but she's Teimania, so she can do it, about Teimania Halakha. In terms of time frame, I'm just confining myself to Rishonim, okay? Now here I'm going to take a position which is different than what you'll hear in the Beis Medrash. The general chronology, when is the difference between Rishonim and Achronim? Rav Shechter, my former Rosh Kollel, I had him too, but he was a lot younger then. I used to say there's Rishonim, Achronim, and Tachtonim. But the difference between Rishonim and Achronim is as follows. Generally, they will tell you in the Beis Medrash that Rav Yosef Karo is the last Rishon and the first Achron. The Shulchan Aruch, in other words, is the dividing line. The same way that Rav Tanu Hu Palig, similarly, Rav Yosef Karo is the cutoff point. For halacha, that is true. From another point of view, I personally think that the cutoff point for our purposes is earlier. Okay, I set the cutoff point between Rishonim and Achronim someplace between the year 1350 and 1400. You'll see in the next session, you'll see why. The reason, 1350, 1360 in Germany and France, and around 1400, in the year 1400, in Spain. Why do I think so? Because if you take a look at how Rishonim learn, Rishonim address the Gemara directly, they interpret it, they interact with it, and they joust with other Rishonim, and they disagree with other Rishonim, and they feel no need, generally speaking, to justify the words of another Rishon. The same way it also says Rashi, forget it, I don't say what he wanted, and the Ravid said it said the Rambam's arrogant, and I don't have to pay attention, and whatever the case might be. In other words, they're playing on the same playing field, and the idea is I have to understand the Gemara the best way I know. Okay. Achronim learn the Gemara through the Rishonim. In other words, the point is, the Gemara is there, but your point of departure is to understand the words of Rishonim, and given a problem between Rashi and Tosfos, you need to come and understand the nature of the argument between them. That is a classically Achronic activity. You don't find that among Rishonim. One exception, one prominent exception is the Ramban. The Ramban, for example, the way he defends the Baal Halachos Gedolos in the Sefer HaMitzvahs, or the way the Ramban defends the Rif, that is true. But that says more about the attitude of Ramban towards the Gaonim and less about the Ramban's attitude towards his contemporaries. All right. So as a result, the second half of the 14th century is where we're going to cut off our discussions. When do we start? We start with the Gemara. So that's already another issue. When do you have the Gemara? So first of all, I said this to a bunch of guys in Lander College last summer, and I thought they were going to run me off on a cross to Golgotha. I said that the Gemara wasn't always written down. And they just looked at me like I was God's apikairis, or not God's apikairis. And I just said, but that's why it's called Torah Shebal Peh. And they said, oh. So, the question of the Gemara is, and there are two questions. When was it redacted? In other words, when was it put in position in the condition that we have it today? And when was it written down? When it was written, the two seem to have happened more or less in tandem. Nobody seems to know exactly who, what, where, and how. One thing we do know is that at some stage, not long after the year 500, 550 CE, the Talmud Bavli was not only redacted, but there was a sense that developed that something fundamental had changed. The nature of Torah Shebal Peh had shifted, and we're in a new ballgame. That shift, for whatever reason it happened, is expressed by the Gemara, this first source you have here, by the Gemara Bav Metziat Daf Pei Vav Amud Aleph, Rebbe v'Reb Nathan self Mishnah, Ravashi v'Ravina self Horah. That the redaction, the finalized, the end of the period of the Tanoim, it comes with the activity of Reb Nathan and Reb Yudah Nasi. And the end of the period of the Gemara, of the Amoraim, is Ravina and Ravashi. Ravina and Ravashi, 500, 520, Mashu Kazim. What happened? What happened? So what happened, Rashi already explains. Self Horah, says Rashi, Self Kol HaMoraim. Ad Yemehem Lo Haisa Gemara Ala Seder. Ela Kishahaisa Sheila Nishela Esbitam HaMishnah Beveis HaMedrash. O Sheila O Sheila Al Maaseh HaMa'ora Bedin Mamen O Isser Beheter. Kol Echad Vechad Omer Tamo. Ravashi Ravina Sidru Shmuos HaMoraim Shilifnehem. Vekavu Al Seder HaMasechtos. Kol Echad Vechad Eitzel HaMishnah Aruya Vashnuyala. Vihikshu Kushio Sheish LaHashiv Uperukim Shiruyim Litareitz. Heim VaMoraim Shimohem. Vekavu HaKol BaGemara Uvau Ravashi Ravina Ukvaum. They were the fancy English word is, it was canonized as a set book. Okay. Was the sugya added later by the Sforoim here and there? Yes. But essentially, the Babli took form and became a closed book. What does that mean? What does that mean? What that means is, halakhically, that rather than being an active part of an ongoing process of mesira, of Torah Shebaal Peh, the way the Tanoim were and the Amoraim, it meant that now rabbinic Judaism had a constitution. I don't know what other word to use. It's not a constitution. It's the only word I can think of is the word that they use in Latin for theological works, but it's a good book, it's a good word. The word is summa. A summation of the entirety of Torah Shebaal Peh. From that point on, the kviyas that Rashi is talking about means that everything now focuses on the interpretation and the understanding of the Gemara, and more importantly, no future opinions or ideas or piskei halacha or anything can be vetted unless it can be backed by the Gemara. The Gra in Choshen Mishpat quotes this Gemara and says that's the reason why you can't disagree with the Gemara, because it was, we'll see in a second how, ratified as the book with the on the assumption that Ravashi and Ravina and all the Amorayim and Svarayim, whoever else were involved in it, organized it in the most precise, structured, formulated way possible. Okay, now, which brings us to the first question. There is something about language that in our world, to which we're not accustomed. We live in a world in which language is fundamentally degenerate. It is cheap. Words, what do you say, talk is cheap? They still say that in America? Talk is cheap. Words are cheap. We just, you know, look, we don't even write words. We wrote R-O-F-L, and we write L-O-L, which I when I was a kid, that was little old lady. Or lots of love. I mean, I didn't know what L-O-L was, laughing out loud. I mean, well, somebody, you know, I-M-H-O. I mean, whatever the case might be, we don't even write. Okay, you know, there used to be an art, I learned it as a kid, Rabbi Ryan probably did also, how to write a letter, right? There was a salutation, and this and that. You guys have no idea what that is. You think it's like 144, if it's not 144 category characters, it doesn't count. Anyways, okay, we live in a world of cheapening, of language being cheapened, okay? That is not the place that Chazal came from, okay? They come from a place where, on the contrary, language is sacred. Words are sacred. And you write in a way that is as precise as possible, as loaded as possible with meaning, and conveys in the fewest number of words the maximum amount of material and information. Rav Sadia Gaon in Emunos V'Deos, discussing the Torah, says That's the reason why, when it comes to Tanakh, we can be so extremely precise in our interpretation. As he puts it, God and nature do nothing in vain. Yes?
Is that including
Rishonim? No, so let me get to this. So in fact, yes, the Gemara was created again in that background of precision and profound respect for language, knowing that a person's neshama is going to be dependent on whether how he understands what the Shabbat says. And the same thing is true of Rishonim. Rishonim write in it with a precision which is absolutely not, does not exist today. All right? If you don't believe me, you should, but if you don't believe me, you can get to any exhibit of the perfect example, the one who's, unfortunately, we don't have any autographs of Rashi. We don't have any autographs of Tosfos. In other words, autographs meaning I don't have a piece of paper that Rashi wrote, that he actually, but we do have the Rambam. And the Rambam in this regard is typical. You can go to any time that there's an exhibit of fragments of the Rambam from the Cairo Geniza. You know what the Cairo Geniza is? Everybody knows? Good. And the Cairo Geniza, and you can see fragments of the Rambam's original notebook. And there was no, you know what whiteout is? Okay. There was no whiteout. There was no review function. There was no cut and paste. Okay. You see the Rambam on these pieces of paper, crossing out and writing over, and crossing out and writing over, until he had precisely what he wanted to say, and he kept working on all of his writings till the day he died. It's one of the reasons why you can't, it's not responsible to compare the Mishnah, the Perush Mishnayos and the Rambam with the Mishnah Torah and say this is Mishnah Rishon and Mishnah Chorona, because the Rambam was working on both of them, constantly updating them until the day he was sick at the end, but until as long as he was still functioning, he kept working. That's the attitude towards writing, precision of writing, against the background of which you find. Rashi is certainly that way. Rashi, as we'll talk about in the next year, Rashi, I don't know if you're aware of this, Rashi codes, Rashi doesn't just give you information, Rashi codes in cross-references. Okay? But you have to be at a certain madrega to catch them. Alright, so for example, Rashi, if there were three sugyas on the same topic, And one sugya has an extra word, and Rashi puts that extra word elsewhere, he's telling you, go look over there. I'll give you an example right off the top of my head, because the one is my favorite, okay? The Gemara Kedushin on two occasions discusses the question of what happens. I mean, this you should know already from day school yet. What happens if two guys walk into the store and there's one thing and the guy who wants a makolet only has one that goes, he left, and they both threw a couple of shekels at him and he doesn't remember to whom he sold the gozi. Where's that sugya? What? Bab Metzia, correct. Bab Metzia daf beis of a beis. It's also in Kiddushin. It's also in Kiddushin. In fact, the Iker Sugya actually is in Kiddushin, not Bab Metzia. But Rashi codes into his comment in Kiddushin, I forgot to write the daf right this minute, it's ayin something, or sama something, the two words, shnayim osin. You could read the Rashi without knowing, even thinking for a second that there's any connection, because it's smooth as silk. But if you're at the section where you pick up these things, Rashi codes in a cross-reference. That's the kind of precision of writing that Rishonim do. Kim'at down the line. The question always is, how come, the big conundrum is the Rashbam. Those of you ever learned Baba Basra, or the last Perek in Psochim, if there was anybody verbose in among the Rishonim, it was the Rashbam, but this is the same Rashbam who wrote the most styptic Perush on Chumash that was ever written. So why he decided he was going to go right is a whole discussion. But in general, but even there, his care in terms of choice of words is very clear. Yes? Okay, you add the Rashbam. Yeah. And they could always find excuses. By the way, in terms of Rishonim, I won't say which Rishon it was, but There are Rishonim and the Rishonim. Not everybody who was consigned to manuscript was a great Godel. We were once learning a certain Masechta with a certain Rishon that everybody uses because there's Rishon Rishonim on that Masechta, and somebody quoted it to Soloveitchik, and the Rav said, "Well, I'll tell you. You know, we call him a Rishon because he lived in the time of the Rishonim, but if he'd been with Rabbeinu Tam or the Ravid, he would have been nothing." So, you know, it's all, it varies. It's not everybody is, not everybody is the Rosh Kibahag. In any event, the Gemara, certainly in Babel, by the 6th century, the Gemara was accepted as, this was it. So that means that Judaism goes from being an ongoing process Talmud Torah becomes an act of studying a text and elucidating a text. It's a whole different ballgame, okay? Because you can no longer disagree with that text. And I will tell you, one of the lines between Orthodoxy and other groups is this one question, which was raised, the point that was raised by the Gra. And that is whether you can disagree with the Gemara. Say, I want to make it up, I don't care about the Gemara. That's the line, among other things. There are other lines too, but that's one of the lines. I gave you other statements along the same lines in terms of the authority of the Gemara. The Rashbam, it's a very important sugya, Kuflam and Mudbeis, because because the Gemara in Bava Basra discusses the question of precedent in Halacha. Those of you know, if you take a look at Choshen Mishpat Kafe, this is the major function there. He says, "Valavala halachos pesukos bedivrei hamoroyim, anything which is explicit in the name, straight out psak in the words of the aroyim, vaday tamchinan dekeven shepsakum uchtavum ravashi ravina shehem sofora vaday aleim tamchinan." The kol shekein sheyesh lanu lismoch halachos aksuvos b'gemara kemo shesidran Ravashi daha kaimelan b'metzia Ravashi v'ravina sof hora. Unless you think this is just an Ashkenazi conspiracy, you can take a look at the line by Rabbi Yitzchak of Carcasson, who was a rebbe, one of the rebbeim of the Rajbo in the middle of the 13th century. He was a Talmud of the Ramban. He writes on Baba Basra as well. Aval achshav ein lanu lazuz. Okay, good. So what, just in general, by what process did the Bavli become the fountain of all Torah Shebal Peh? So here there were two different positions. Because there was a competitor, and it was called the Yerushalmi. And the Chachamim Eretz Yisrael, they were very clear. Kimi Tzion Teitzei Torah V'Advar Shem Yerushalayim, not from Brooklyn. It's called Yerushalmi, by the way, in memory of Yerushalayim, because Jews were not allowed to live in Yerushalayim under the Byzantines, when in fact the Yerushalmi was formulated. Therefore, Yerushalmi was formulated in Tveria, maybe a little bit in the Golan, but in any event, it was finished off about 100 years before the Bavli, around the year 400. So you have two Gemaras. So what? How did the Bavli win out? So there are two halakhic explanations, and there is one historical explanation. There's no contradiction between them. The halakhic explanations are actually a machlokas between the Rith and the Rambam. The Rith at the end of Erevin, this is Daf Lamed Hey Amud Beis in the Dapim of the Rith, discusses a business in. Machlokas of Bavli and Yerushalmi on a certain Machlokas in Ul and the Chachamim, and he quotes the Yerushalmi. But one of the ironies in life is the fact that Sephardim and Edot HaMizrahi use the Yerushalmi a lot more than Ashkenazim, despite what I said to you earlier. But anyway, so the Rish says as follows: Va'anan lo, I'm sorry about the formatting; it didn't stick. Anan lo sviralan hachi dekeven desugim degemara dilan lehetera. Lo ich paslan b'may da asri b'gemara de me'ma arava. I don't care what the Yerushalmi. So what? Dal gemara de lan samchinan de basrohu the inu of a bekir b'gemara de b'nei ma'arava tfei menan v'lav de kimlu the high me'mer de b'nei ma'arava lav de samchu lo kashar olay ma'inu. What does he say? For the first time in the history of halacha, the Rif invokes the term of halacha kebasroi. We follow the later opinion. Now, we've got to be careful. Halacha kebasroi doesn't mean me. It doesn't mean you. It doesn't mean anybody in generation older than me either. The Basroi are always a few generations back, who were close enough to the original people to be able to effectively evaluate the various arguments. So what the Rif is saying is, look it, the Amorayim B'Bavel were also Amorayim. They saw the Yerushalmi, they evaluated the Yerushalmi, they saw in this case we shouldn't accept their halach, their psak, and goodbye. In other words, put differently, the Babli was accepted because it's simply the better book. It's more extensive, it's better argued, it's better presented, it's more organized, and it includes everything that Yerushalmi includes, plus. Bottom line is, though, that the Babli is it, because of its quality and because it was accepted, whether ostensibly informally, by Klal Yisrael. In that regard, halakhically, tradition binds and precedent binds. The Rambam takes something of a different tack. It's a little bit easier to handle. He says in the Hakdamah to the Mishnah Torah, he says, "Nimtzer Ravina Ravashi v'chavreihem sof gedolei chachmei Yisrael amatikin Torah shebalpeh v'shegazru gzeiros v'iskidu takonos v'nehigu minhagos v'pashta gzeirosam v'takonosam v'nagosam b'chol Yisrael b'chol ha'mekomos v'shvosa v'achar bezdin shor Ravashi shechiber ha'gemara v'gamru b'gemaro b'imei b'no nispazru Yisrael b'chol ha'aratzos pizur yeser." They scattered all over the world. V'igiu l'ktzavos v'iyim ha'rachokim the rabsa ktata ba'ola v'nishtabshu adrochem b'giyasos v'nismat talmud Torah v'lo nifnesu Yisrael lilmud b'shivos seyem alofim v'revavos k'mo shayu mikodem. Aval kol advarim shebegemara habavli chayovin kol Yisrael alechas v'hem v'chofin kol ir v'ir v'chol medina v'medina linhog v'chol ha'minhogo shenagu chachme ha'gemara v'ligzor gzeirosam v'lalechas v'takanosam hoil v'chol osam advarim shebegemara hiskimu aleyem kol Yisrael. The osem achachamim shiskino ushigazru unhigu ushidonu din v'londu shamishpat kachu hein kol chachmi Yisrael urubam them shishamu akabola bikori atorah kula dorach ardorah Moshe Rabbeinu olav shalom. What's the Rambam arguing? The Rambam is saying the Gemara was ratified not just by chachamim but by all of Klal Yisrael. Okay? How do I know? Because the language the Rambam uses here, he uses in one other place in Hilchos Mamrim, based on a discussion, the central discussion on the power of Chazal to legislate extra halachic things like takonos, gzeros, and minhagos. That's a vazor al daf lamed vav amud aleph amud beis. The Rambam writes in the Perek Beis of Hilchos Mamrim, Halacha Beis, bezdin shegazru gzera, otiknu takona. Then higu minig upasha tadavar b'chol Yisrael ve'amar achreihem bezdin acher ubikesh levatel dvarim rishonim v'lakar osa takana v'osa gzer v'osa minig eno yachol ad shiagadol min rishonim v'chachvu minyan. Notice the first line. It was ordained and then what? Upashat b'chol Yisrael. The process of legislation by the Sanhedrin requires ratification by the people. So the Rambam is essentially saying the same thing is true when it comes to the Gemara. It was ratified by the whole Jewish people. So therefore, it's binding. In theory, no, if you had a Bezdin, Godel, B'chol, B'min, B'chol, B'minyan, so you could overturn that. But that such a thing is impossible. So it formally was enacted. All right? Give me an example of a takana which was enacted but wasn't pashut b'chol Yisrael. You encounter one every single year. No. Why? You don't read the Megillah?
No.
It was pashut b'chol Yisrael. Yeah, fair. Okay. Right, give me one that wasn't. What? Oh, yeah, that's another story. Yes. Come again. Tefillah b'al Avayah, no, because Tefillah b'al Avayah b'al Keri was overturned because Al Pidin, because he made Dvarai Ba'esh. It's a good possibility, but it's not. Yes.
Not eating meat.
Not eating meat when? No, that's just a minig. Yes. What? No, much later. And by the way, if a Prussian, if that was the first thing we hear about Kitnios is in the 12th century. I'm talking about something for something earlier. Yes. Again, that's true. Only affects those places that were accepted. Something even much more by Chazal. Takana of Chazal that was enacted but wasn't Prussian Rav Yisrael and therefore fell off. Maybe. Yes. Ah, that's an interesting question. I don't go there. No, because if you ask somebody, they'll tell you no music is allowed, period. Davar shetipula b'netilas yadayim for davar shetipula b'mashke. Okay? At the same time, netilas yadayim for pot, everybody does, because pashat b'shrov b'shroya. However, the din is, takonis chazal, that before you have a salad, or anything shetipula b'mashke, you have to wash your hands, because yayin yadayim shneos letuma v'shalasos antchila. Okay? Where do you encounter this? On Pesach, because when the Seder was organized, the jury was still out on Davar Shetipula B'Mashke. So the Mishnah still says you should do it. But we don't do it. Okay? So the Seder are frozen in time. And that's the subject of Machlokas, the Gru on the Taz. Because the Taz says you don't make a bracha on that Netilas Yadayim on the contrary. A lot of places that it's only the Bala Seder. It's only the Orach HaSeder who does it. In my house where it's brisker, so everybody does it. But you don't say a bracha. The Gru says no. The Takon is still in place and you should still say a bracha. You may not have to, but if you're going to already, you should say a bracha. But Pasha, Bashat B'Rav Yisrael, the ratification by the Jewish people, is the determining factor, and that's exactly what the Rambam has. So why is the Gemara required? Why it's either ratified or it's spread by implicit acceptance. Either way, it is the beginning. Rishon v'Achron umi baladav end. So therefore, now all Torah Shebal Peh, all halacha is now dependent on the elucidation and understanding of this enormous text, summa, collection, known as the Talmud Bavli. Okay, one of the reasons why the Rambam is so emphatic here is something else, because he was dealing with people who rejected the Gemara, namely the Karaites. It's another topic for another discussion. Okay, now, those of you, if you can admit, now, imagine if somebody just gave you, okay, I'm glad you're all sitting, imagine there's no Schottenstein in the world. Imagine there's no Steinsaltz in the world. Imagine there's no Sansino. Do you still use Sansino ever? Yeah. There's no Sansino, there's no Jastro, there's no Melamed, there's no Schechter. Okay? Nothing, nada. What you got is a big manuscript, is a big thing with the Gemara, and maybe not even written down. And somebody says, here. And then you go, you've got to be kidding. What is it about the Gemara that makes it difficult to understand? So on the one hand, this is the, on the other hand, how am I supposed to, what makes this safer difficult? I mean, because the truth of the matter is, if you open up, forget about this for a second, if you open up a Gemara and you know Aramaic, assuming you know Aramaic, and there were now indications, by the way, that people knew Aramaic far longer than we thought they did. One of my teachers, Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, argues that Jews, for example, in Ashkenaz, apparently knew, well, but he doesn't have to make, it's not just his, he makes the point for other reasons, but Jews were writing poetry and piyutim in Aramaic in Ashkenaz in the 11th century still. In other words, in the lifetime of Rashi. They were still reciting Targum as part of Kriyas HaTorah in the time of Rashi and beyond. In fact, maybe we'll get off the first page. In fact, Agdamus, what's Agdamus? Agdamus is a poet in what? I know, nobody pays attention because it's 5 in the morning and you're all asleep. Okay, very nice. But it was written as an introduction to the Targum on Aseres HaDibra, Parshas Matan Torah. Because they used to recite the Targum in Aramaic as part of the Kriyas HaTorah. Which will explain a famous episode in rabbinic history. The Shagas Aryeh was actually was Rebbe Muvik of Reb Chaim Volozhiner. And he got a job in Metz. So he went to Metz, and he comes to Metz, and he sees that the minig in Metz was they would say that the Olah LaTorah for the first Aliyah on Shavuos would say the brachas. Then they would read Bachodesh HaShlishi, and then they would do Hakdamas. So the Shalag HaSayyeh went ballistic, and he said, no, you can't do that. That's a hefsek in the Kriyas HaTorah. You can't do that. You have to do Hakdamas first. And they said, who do you think you are? This is the way we've been doing it since Dori Dora, since Adam HaRishon. And he left. And according to the rabbinic folklore, the Shalag HaSayyeh went out, he started his own shtiebel, and never went back to the main shul in Metz until he died during the siege of Metz in the middle of the 18th century. What was the minig based on? Because it used to be the beginning of the Targum, so that was considered part of Kriyas HaTorah, no hefsek. Okay? In any event. So assume you know, so even if you know Aramaic, the Gemara, if you open up a Sansino and you just read the text, it's not all that difficult. What's missing? Punctuation, number one. What else? Nekudot. Let's assume we can read without Nekudot. Okay? What else? Background information. The Gemara assumes, the whole Gemara is written, as part of its genius, is written in a telegraphic or telegrammatic style. Basic information, and no more than that. In fact, somebody once told me, why is it that at the end of, it's like the worst thing to say, but when you daven up a Gemara, okay, like Daf Yomi, right? When you daven up a Gemara, right, and you go through like the Daf Wa yesterday, the day before yesterday, okay, it's a full of psukim, all right? Did you ever notice that there's a little vigimel vav chupchik at the end of a pasuk? Mm-hmm. Do you know what that means? Read the pasuk. Big kiddush. You know what? Sometimes the pshat is based on the second part of the pasuk, which isn't even cited by the Gemara. The assumption is that you come to the Gemara with at least knowing Tanakh by heart. Okay. The Gomer may even be an instruction. That might be the Shavuot also. All right. So you need information to be able to understand it, just to make a landing. All right. That information requires study. Strikingly, and this is really incredible. You'll ask me a question. So why is it? I said before, the first systematic perushim on the Gemara. Only date from the 11th century. Okay, that they were both started in tandem. One in North Africa. Okay, and one in Germany. The one in North Africa was by Rabbeinu Hananel ben Khushiel in Cairo 1, which is a city in North Africa. It's in Algeria today. No, it's not in Algeria. It's in Libya today. Okay, and the other one is in Mainz. Mainz, Germany, it was started, a collective thing, started by Rabbeinu Gershom Mor HaGola, who died in 1028. But it's called Perush HaRagmala Gemara, but it's not really his. He started the process. It was a group effort that went generation after generation in the yeshiva of Mainz. The entire yeshiva would learn together whatever masechtas, and it just continued to grow. So what they do, I mean, the Gemara is finished in 500. Jews are spreading out all over the world, as the Rambam says correctly, in the meantime. So you have 400 years or 450 years, no Perush. So what do you do? During this period of time, the keys to the kingdom of Torah Shebal Peh are held by whom? By the Gaonim. The Gaonim are, there are only two yeshivas in the world. By the way, that's important to keep in mind, all right? The original meaning of the word yeshiva doesn't mean just like anybody opens up, you know, yeshivas korba kotel. That's not what the word means. A yeshiva means an ecumenical worldwide institution. There were three yeshivot in the world. Three. Two in Bavel, Sura and Bombadita, both of which by then had relocated to Baghdad because that was the big city. Okay? And the third one was in Eretz Yisrael. The head of at least two of them was called a Gaon, not just because of their personal That's just because of their personal, qualifications, because their title was Rosh Yeshivat Geon Yaakov, the head of the yeshiva, which is the pride of Jacob. In fact, they found the lintel. At one point, the Yeshivat Eretz Yisrael was actually in Katsrin, up in the Golan, and they found the remains of the Beis Medrash of the yeshiva with that. In fact, with that inscription, and on occasion you can see it at the Israel Museum. It's actually two of the coolest things I ever saw in the Israel Museum. In 1999, they marked the conquest of Eretz Yisrael by the Crusaders. So they pulled out a whole bunch of Crusade era stuff that they had in the in the warehouse. So one of the things was a sign, which is really neat, but the neatest thing in the world was the Ramban's signet ring that some guy found in Nir Akko, because the Ramban apparently died in Nir Akko, and it really is this Moshe ben Nachman Geronensis, and they stuck it into wax to see how it looked like. It's like cool as a moose, because where else are you going to find anything that the Ramban actually, that he wore this ring? One of those moments. It's like that piece of Rambam that I told you about. Anyways, the world was basically run, especially by the Gaonim of Bavel. So why didn't they write a parish on the Gemara? In fact, they wrote hundreds of comments. People would send them letters from all over the world, asking, what does this mean, and what does this sugya mean, and how should I paskin this way, and paskin that way? Don't forget, 95% of the Jews of the world were what we call Sephardim, in other words, in the broad sense, until around the year 1500. Ashkenazim were a measly little, teeny-weeny, insignificant minority of the Jews. Then, for reasons which we don't know, the demographics flipped, but until then, the overwhelming majority of Jews lived within the Muslim world, and the males worked. Male worked a lot better than the state of Israel male works. And people would write. They have thousands of letters in the Karaganiza. Because what would happen? A guy in Spain would ask a shaila of a question on a sugya to whoever the gun of Sura Pumadita was. The letter would come to Cairo or to Fustat, which is where the Jewish community was, and they would copy it because they want to know what the question was. Well, they're actually more interested with the answers. So they wait for the answers to come, they copy them down. And that's why we have much of this material was preserved as an entire collection called Otsar HaGeonim, which I'm sure is upstairs in the Beis Medrash, and if not, it's in the library. Which contains all kinds of pshatim, but it's not a full parish. It's not a full parish. So how come? So the Gaonim themselves gave us something of an answer. Look at number two. Towards the end of the 10th century, around 900, that was when Rabbeinu Gershom is already hard at work on his parish in Mainz. Rav Shira Gaon is writing to Jews in North Africa, asking them to renew their connections with the yeshiva because there had been wars and rebellions against the central government in Baghdad, which had cut communications between Cairo 1 in North Africa and Babylonia in Iraq. And the Rav Shira Gaon says as follows: if you tell yourselves that you kitisharun atem amat kuntechem, there's been 10 years, we haven't heard from you, we've done okay by ourselves, learning on our own, what do you want? Lo yishachtun, nothing's going to go bad, midrashechem, vayishiva nishchetet, ma kara, it's okay, we'll live. He says, halo roshechem heima, kvod roshechem shiftechem, ve'ech yishachet harosh v'shalem aguf, v'achar harosh aguf holech. We are the Rosh. We are the heirs of Ravashi and Ravina. We have all the pshatim, we have all the information, we have all the authority. You have to write to us, because otherwise you will in fact get lost. The last line is particularly poignant. V'ulam arba amos shel halacha hineihem. They're here in Bavel. V'zos hatzura hu b'makom ha-Sanhedrin. The yeshiva has taken the place of the Sanhedrin as an authority. V'rosha hu b'makom Moshe Rabbeinu. And the Gaon is like Moshe Rabbeinu. In other words, there is a center of halachic authority. We are it, and we are therefore, you must defer to us, to Paskin Shilas, and to study. Why? So Reb Shmuel ben Eli, who was a contemporary of the Rambam, tells us exactly why. He says, so this is like 150 years later. V'zot ha-Torah v'odata lahem et ha-derech yel-chuba v'et ha-maaseh asher yasun ki bazeh nishmarot datot Yisrael mitkayen ma shebiyadam me'amunatam shelo yit'u v'lo yit'u ma'amitot. We can guarantee quality control. If you don't turn to us, you'll make mistakes. You're not trained. If you want to be a proper Talmud Chacham, you've got to send your children to us, or your best students to us, to study in the yeshivas of Bavel and to attain the skills and the information necessary to understand. We will then have a Talmud Rebbe relationship with them to make sure you don't make errors. Chevre, this isn't a game. A person who starts to learn Gemara and doesn't have the tools and doesn't have the requisite Yerushalayim can make a Churban like nobody's business. Never mind Amaratis. So the Gaon is saying this is quality control. Because we are the ones who inherited Ravina and Ravashi. We have information that's nowhere else. So it's all very good. What do they call it? Long distance learning. Long distance learning is wonderful. I've been listening to some of the courses that Yale put up online. Phenomenal. Okay. But when you're learning a text, when you're learning Torah, there's no substitute. The best MP3 shiur in the world is no substitute for being able to raise your hand and ask. And if a Rebbe has a sense of responsibility, that's what Sar Shalom Gaon wrote in the 9th century. I was looking for the tshuva, I couldn't find it. He says, look, if you came here, we could talk it out. And then I could know that you understand. But what if you go around and you don't understand? You'll paskin, people will be Mechalel Shabbos and Lee Trafus and Mary Arias and God knows what else. All right, maybe they'll daven twice Myriv, and if they forgot Yalla V'Yavav, that's not the worst thing. How else do you able? Well, you're gonna learn. I don't know if you're familiar with the Israeli rock group Kaveret, otherwise known as Pugi. Okay, so one of their most famous, one of the most, but really best known songs is called Yo-Yo. So you had Tayadam Ratzal Leskot Kidei Latzuf Kavua Lamad Chiyah Behit Katvut Etzel Matzil Yadua Shenichnas Lasof Layam Tok Shniotu Ne'alam Shnaim Kapsu Elav Miyad Tovarim Shnaim Mina Echad. The two guys died, drowned because of the guy who, I mean, that's a joke. But well, it's not. You shouldn't learn life saving by correspondence either. But the point is that the Gaon is saying, no, I can't write a parish because otherwise I'll be putting the Torah into hands which are not qualified. You have to have a right to an opinion. And so as a result, they didn't. They wrote all kinds of perushim and sort of nekudati, pointed specific comments, but nothing global. However, the secular historians would say it's a historical process. The frum historians would say it was hashgacha. In 1038, the last of the great Gaonim died, Rav Hai, and Bavel went into decline. And it was precisely at that time that both Sephardim, and here I mean North Africa, and now really we're talking about Spain, because Spain ends up becoming the leader of what becomes the Edot HaMizrach for a very long time, and in Germany, both communities start developing commentaries on all of Shas. Now, there is a difference between the two of them. And the difference between the two of them, what they try to do, is a direct reflection of how each tradition views the act of Talmud Torah and the goal of learning. Okay. And that in turn is a function of the question of what am I looking for? What is the Gemara providing me with? Put differently, is there such a thing as when a person sits down to learn, is he looking for the one unilateral halachic truth of which there was one and no other? Or is he looking for a reasonable, responsible, plausible, credible possibility in the Gemara? Now that's going to sound, that might be a little bit jarring to you, but that is a fundamental machlokus between Ashkenaz and Sfard on the question of what does Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim Chayim mean? Okay. We're waiting for Rabbi Tarragon to come, or? Okay, if we can wait a few more, we're okay for a few more minutes? Okay. That's a major, major machlokus. And once we're finished with it, you'll understand a lot better the world in which we live and the interaction between Ashkenazim and Sephardim. So let's take a look. It's the locus classicus is the Gemara in the Arabin, Daf Gimel Amud Beis. By the way, Elu Ve'elu Divrei Elokim Chayim does not mean that anybody who says anything and pretends that it's Jewish is automatically legitimate. The one Gemara that certain Orthodox rabbis and spokesmen like to throw around, Zeilu Ve'ela Divrei Elokim Chayim, that's not really, it's sort of like Tikkun Olam, it's overstated at best. In any case, Amar Rabbi Yama, Amar Shmuel. There was an Aleph there, except that I didn't highlight it fast enough. Shalosh anim nechlaku beishame beishila. Halalo amrim halacha kemoseinu, valalo amrim halacha kemoseinu. Yatza baskol va'amro, elu ve'elu dibri lekim chayim, valocha ke beishila, v'chim yakar she'elu ve'elu dibri lekim chayim, mibnei ma'azachu beishila, lekvo halacha kemosan, mibnei shenochin v'aluvim, or olvim hayu, aluvim, sorry, v'shonim dibrayim v'dibrayim v'shamay, v'lo'od shalim akdimim v'dibrayim v'shamay v'dibrayim. What does that mean, elu ve'elu dibri lekim? Something can't be Tameh and Tar at the same time. So, this is the machlokus between Chachmei Ashkenaz and Chachmei Sfarad. Chachmei Sfarad. As long as we know them, and going all the way back to the Gaonim, we're of the opinion that, and what's the flip side of that? The flip side of that is machlokus a good thing? Or a bad thing? That we have to get used to. Okay? I know the old joke is that's the minute we used to fight. So the Sephardic position almost consistently is machlokus is a bad thing. If there were no machloksin, that would be best. The Rambam says, I'll start off a little bit off the beaten track, but the Rambam says it best in the Mor Nebuchim Chelek Aleph Perek Ayin Aleph. He writes, after a long discussion about various philosophical issues, he writes, Da, ki achokmos harabos asher ayubu masenu b'amisas elu ha'anyonim. He says, we originally had a philosophical tradition. On the contrary, the Greeks got it from us. Abdu baruch hazman. But our philosophical tradition got lost. Why? Time, u'bishlota u'mosas chalot aleinu, golus, trouble, travail. You know, when you're trying to run for your life, you're not sitting there worrying about the unmoved mover. But not only that, ubihiyosa inyonim ha'hem biltim utarim l'bnei adam kulam kamoshe be'arnu. Not everybody was allowed to learn philosophy. The Rambam held the philosophy in Maaseh Merkava was the same thing. Okay, he thought Maaseh Breishis was physics and Maaseh Merkava was metaphysics. So when the Mishnah Chagiga says that in fact ein mosrim Maaseh Merkava ein darshan b'nasa kamoshe be'yachid, all these things had to be kept esoteric. And I see Rabbi Tarragon is here. So we will continue this. Two more minutes. Okay. Okay. So he says. So what do you want? We had terrible circumstances, terrible persecutions, and not only that, but not everybody knew this stuff. He says, "Ukvaya data." You already know. Shafilu a Talmud a Mekuvo. Lohaya Mechuver b'Sefer Mikedem. Linyan is Pashay Buma. So not everybody is able to read it. Why? Because of the Gemara in Gittin. Dvarim shamarti lecha al pe, yet arashay lomram bichsav. And he says, and keeping the Torah of al pe oral was the smartest thing he could have done. Because the minute you wrote it, and they're going to get a copy, and you get Yenim, you know, Yenikunalemel goes in and buys himself a Gemara. Look what happened. Rotzelam Arov Hadayos Vistargamus Fekos Naflos Bilashon Machurba Besefer Ushkaga Tischaberlo Vitischade Shamachlokas Veina Anoshim. Because we didn't have one place they could do, it sounds like the Gaonim. Quality control, and everybody's doing his own thing, so they all say, well, this looks like this, and this looks good to me, and this looks good to me, and you have machlokos. In other words, machlokos happens as a result of lack of training, lack of knowledge, and no quality control. The Rambam comes back to that. I'm not going to read the whole thing here. The Rambam comes back to that. If you take a look in the passage from the second, third parak of the Hakdamot Perek Shmos Nice, the Rambam comes back to that and says, no. The Rambam could divide the Torah Shabbat into five parts. And he makes a point of saying there's no machlokas over here, there's no machlokas over there, and nobody had a machlokas about that, nobody ever differed about that. It's only when Jews started, you know, when they started not doing their homework. They quote the Gemara in Sanhedrin about Talmidei Beis Shammai Beis Hillel Shalashim Shu Shravosem Kol Tzorcham. That's when you have machlokas. Machlokas is a sign of deficiency. If people would have done their homework, if we had the tools, we could actually arrive at the total truth. So Elu ve'elu Divril Kimchaya means what? It means they're both done from the same method. They're done out of Yerushalayim. They're developed out of the proper stance. But at the end of the day, only one is right and only one, and one is wrong. And you have to strive as much as possible to do that right. Lest you tell me it's only the Rambam, the Beis Yosef, and his Hakdama to the Beis Yosef, to Rabbi Yosef Cairo, to the Torah says, Baruch Hashem Elokei Yisrael Asher Bara Olamo L'Taklis HaAdam U'Mikol Min HaAdam Bocha Lo Am Segulo Yaakov Chevel Nachlosa U'Meirov Ha'avos Olam Krovo V'Kervanu V'Nei HaSinai V'Nchilanu Al Yedei Mivchar HaMin HaEnoshi Moshe Rabbeinu Olam Shalom Toru Mitzvus Chukim Mishpatin Tzadikim V'Toflanu L'Man Neilech B'Drachah V'Nimtzachin V'Einav V'Yehi Ki Arku Lanu HaYomim. Don't forget, he was expelled from Spain. Horaknu Mikli Al Kli U'Vagola Halachnu Become a tsaros tsuros tchufos with tsaros zolazo bow alenu ad kiniskayim banu bavarosenu vadach hochmas kachonim vaz las yara torah velom dea kilona seisa torah kishtei toros elekitoros ein misport. There's endless machlokos, endless torahs. And what's the job of the Shulchan Aruch? Unity. One Torah from one roeh. Everybody says the same thing. Because there's only one emes. Kael emes, like Rav Chaim Volozhin used to say. Kael emes, nosam lan toras emes, v'toras yedichzipa emes, ein alakim la emes, einenu. Take a look at Shut Chushta Meshulishim and Yudalat at the end. Okay? The person who dreamed of doing that more than anybody else in the last generation was Rabbi Yosef. Ravarn told me on the way in that I'm competing with the Rav Ovadia the discussions after Hanukkah, so that's my connection. All right, that is why, and with this we'll close. That is why, gentlemen, only Spartan writes codes. Only Spartan writes unilateral Sifrei Halachos. Tell me the names of the Sifrei Halacha. Who are the big poskim? The rabbi asked us in Shir in Boston. We had a little group of like 5-10 of us. We stood privately with him. So you see, once he looked at it, he said, so who are the biggest poskim in Yiddishkeit? So we all start throwing out names. This and that. And the rabbi said, you're all wrong. The caterers, the printers, and the photographers. That's not what I had in mind. What? Who are the great? Who are the poskim? No? Start early. No? Rambam. The Rif. No? The Rambam. No? Next. Allah is Gedolah is good. The tour. The tour was what? Ashkenazi, but he lived in? Yeah. Paletta. Good. Next. Who else? Shulchan Aruch. No? No, the Ashkenazi don't write codes. Because we'll see. Ah, that you'll have to wait until December. They write Balagan. Ashkenazi like a Balagan, but that will have to wait And in the meantime, have a Chag Urim Sameach, if you ever heard the expression.